the Honorable Mark Whittington.
May I please report Mr. Richard Townsend will present argument for related bills.
May it please the court. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. I appreciate your granting our motion for leave to file. Seated with me at the council table, incidentally, is Ms. Jennifer Juden, who is the trial counsel in this case. I want to visit with you for a few minutes this morning about what I think is an extremely important area of the pretrial practice. Our client, Myrna Coates, the relator, is the plaintiff in a personal injury action against Drackett Products, the real party in interest, and the case is in Judge Mark Whittington's court. Judge Whittington, of course, is the respondent. Judge Whittington has entered an order directing Mrs. Coates to undergo a mental examination, and that's the basis of this action, the basis of this mandamus proceeding. Now, the controversy is grounded on Rule 167A of the Rules of Civil Procedure. That rule, as you know, is the physical and mental examination rule, and it provides that when the mental or physical condition of a party is in controversy, the court may order for good cause, and I'm paraphrasing here, a mental or physical examination. Now, let me note at the outset that as I read the law, that rule imposes a somewhat different standard than the 166B discovery rule, our basic discovery rule, because instead of talking as 166B does in terms of relevancy and the possibility of leading to admissible evidence, Rule 167A makes the twin requirements that the matter be in controversy and that there be a demonstration of good cause for the physical or mental examination. So the fundamental question before this court today is, under what conditions may a trial judge order a party to submit to a mental examination? I'm not here to talk about physical examinations because that's not in controversy in this case. A mental examination is. Let me see if I can outline for you the parameters of the controversy. As I indicated at the outset, our client, Mrs. Coates, filed a lawsuit against Drackett Products. It's an ordinary negligence products liability case. Mrs. Coates was cleaning her oven with Mr. Muscle oven cleaner, and she began to spray the oven cleaner on one of the burners, holding the burner in her hand as she did so, and she sprayed her arm. It happened at the time that she had burned her arm, one area of her arm, slightly a few days before that. For reasons that are not in the record, the sprayed area became inflamed, and eventually she suffered scarring and discoloration on the arm, and that's what led, of course, to this lawsuit. Now, we sued Drackett as the distributor and alleged as part of our damages, and I believe it's item 4 of our damage allegations, plaintiff has suffered mental anguish in the past and in all reasonable probability will sustain mental anguish in the future. Let me note at this point that we do not, contrary to some of the arguments made by Drackett, we do not say permanent mental anguish. We simply make the general allegation of mental anguish in the future. Now, that's the only allegation in the plaintiff's pleadings about the mental state of Mrs. Coates. The mental anguish that we have alleged, of course, is, in our view, the mental anguish that this court discussed and I think defined quite well in the fairly recent opinion of Moore versus either Lilibo or Lilibo, I'm not sure of the pronunciation, opinion of Justice Campbell, and I believe Justices Spears and Gonzalez dissented. In the case, Justice Campbell's opinion defines mental anguish as an emotional response to an injury. And he goes on, the opinion goes on to say that it is the deep inner feeling of pain and hurt, often born in silence. This is the type of thing we're dealing with in this case, of course, by your definition of mental anguish, when we allege mental anguish. Now, let me also note that we have announced in open court in this case that we have no intention of using psychiatrists, psychologists, healthcare experts. I would anticipate, would present whatever proof of mental anguish we are going to present from the plaintiff, possibly from lay witnesses. We are not alleging or contending that there is some deep-seated mental disturbance or mental illness that has resulted from this injury. Now, in the responsive pleadings, Drackett also has an allegation that is pertinent to this hearing today. Drackett has alleged that defendant further has alleged as follows. Defendant further asserts that plaintiff allegedly suffered from depression, inability to eat or sleep, and other personal problems treated by medical care providers immediately prior to the incident made the basis of this lawsuit. All or part of plaintiff's alleged damages are attributable to her pre-existing condition. Now, that's the basic framework of our lawsuit as far as the pleadings and the basic facts. The allegation by Mrs. Coates of the mental anguish she incurred because of the burn and the scarring. The response by Drackett that, to some extent at least, her injury was caused by a pre-existing condition. Our announcement that we do not intend to use any type of health care experts. And then, of course, the motion by Drackett, pardon me, and the order of the trial court directing Mrs. Coates to submit to a mental examination. And incidentally, in resolving this kind of problem, we have not argued, and I don't think there is any reason to distinguish between the various kinds of health care providers, whether we're talking about a psychologist, as we are in this case, a psychiatrist, or perhaps some other person in the field. The rule speaks simply to a mental exam and does not try to distinguish among the various ones. So I think in considering the problem, we must consider it as if any one of the available health care, mental health persons could be used and directed to conduct the mental exam. Now, how did the controversy arise specifically? Well, during discovery, Drackett developed the following information about Mrs. Coates. In the year before the accident, she had certain personal problems. They were caused by her son's illness. Her son had an ongoing illness of several years' duration. She had lost a high-paying job and been required to take a lower-paying one because her employer had moved to another city. And she had some marital problems resulting from her husband's misuse of alcohol. Because of that, she had seen a doctor two or three times, and I don't have the exact number of times in front of me, but once or twice, two or three, somewhere in that range. She had advised the doctor that she was depressed, that she was nervous, that she was having trouble sleeping, having trouble eating. There are notations in her medical records that she was nervous and upset, that she was not sleeping and eating, a notation of depression at one point. And she described her situation in her deposition when she said, mentally, I was depressed. The doctors prescribed an antidepressant, which incidentally she was not taking at or near the time of the incident that led to this lawsuit.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Let me interrupt. There was an additional notation in the record of she had suicidal tendencies.
Let me speak specifically to that because I think that needs to be clarified. Since law school days, we've heard of the have you stopped beating your wife question, and that's the classic situation that we have here. The exact notation on the medical record that was made in connection with the incident that this lawsuit's based on is, husband states patient depressed, dash, denies suicidal tendency. And that's all there is that I am aware of and that anyone has demonstrated to me is in the medical records about suicidal tendencies, that the husband denies suicidal tendencies. So far as I can develop or discover, there is absolutely no evidence in this record that this plaintiff has any suicidal tendencies whatsoever. Now, that's what we have on Mrs. Coates' mental health before the accident. That's it. The depression, because of the personal problems that had gone on for some period prior to the time she was injured. The day of the injury, the notation in the record by her husband, and they were reconciling at that time, incidentally, and have since reconciled, that she was depressed, but a denial of suicidal tendencies. Now, based on that record, and that's what the trial judge had, and that's all the trial judge had, Judge Whittington has ordered the mental examination. The order is in the record before you, and it's quite extensive order, and I'll talk a little bit about the internal workings of it if time permits, but he simply ordered that Mrs. Coates undergo a mental examination and provided in the order that the manner and scope of the examination shall be defined by the court in direct contact with the doctor that was selected by Judge Whittington. Now, there's one other side of this that is important, one other aspect of these facts. At a later time, Mrs. Coates' deposition was taken, and she was asked to describe the mental anguish, if you will, that she is seeking to recover damages for. And she said the scar from the burn on her arm is ugly, bothers her in public, and makes her very self-conscious. Now, that's important when you consider it in relation to the pre-existing mental conditions that the Dracket Products Company relied upon and the court relied upon in entering this mental exam order. Ugly, bothers her in public, makes her very self-conscious. No relation between that kind of mental anguish and the depression, the denied suicidal tendencies that existed prior to the time that that she was injured. What I'm saying is there is no evidence that now, because of this injury, she is depressed, suicidal, having trouble sleeping, taking tranquilizers. Simply no relation between the two kinds of events. So I think the issue is clearly framed. This, of course, is an abuse of discretion situation. And the thing you must determine is whether Judge Whittington abused his discretion in ordering this mental exam. I'm going to talk about the law for a few minutes and try to demonstrate to you why I think he did. But let me just say as an aside that I hope the court will use this case as a vehicle to analyze Rule 167 insofar as it speaks to mental examinations and establish the guidelines, the framework within which these mental examinations must be ordered.
Now, would there be a difference between your case and one where there were physical injuries involved, say an automobile collision? We've got to write a rule, and I'm here to tell you there's another case right behind yours involved.
Involving physical damage?
Yes.
I think at the outset you have this, and this is something I may have to expound on if questions are asked, but I think ordinarily in the physical injury case, right at the outset, you have medical testimony. The plaintiff is going to have to put some doctors on or some kind of medical people to say what's wrong with you. In my view, that alone brings the matter into controversy and gives good cause for the issuance of physical examination orders. Now, they must be issued, I think, very carefully and must be relevant or at least pertinent to the kinds of injuries that are involved in the case and that kind of thing. But I think at the outset, you're going to have that situation where it's obvious that the plaintiff is going to use some type of medical testimony to support his claim. That is enough, I think, to warrant the ordering of the examination. I think in this case, a mental examination case, if we were going to use psychiatric or psychological testimony to try to explain and describe and support the mental anguish suffered by Mrs. Coates, then I think we have, again, established on our own, on behalf of Drackett, the good cause and the in-controversy requirements of the rule. Now, one further thing I'll say about that, I really can't conceive of this, but if it were a physical injury case where no medical testimony was going to be tendered by the plaintiff, then I think you might have an entirely different situation, but I've never seen a case like that, so I...
Well, assume that husband and wife are in the automobile, and there's a head-on collision. Husband is killed, and he's the driver. Wife is just sitting next to him in the passenger seat, and she's not injured at all. She's going to sue for mental anguish.
Right. Well, of course, I believe that's the Moore case. Again, I think if it's the ordinary mental anguish, as we understand that term, as you defined it in the Moore case, and as we understand that term under Texas law, without Moore, our view would be that that's not enough to place it in controversy and provide good cause for a mental examination.
Let me get you off of your line of thought and something that concerns me. It's really ancillary to this total question, and that is, what is the state of Rule 167A at the present time insofar as the trial bench, when they grant a 167A motion, appointing physicians suggested by the defendant in the lawsuit to perform the medical exam, or is the trial judge making an independent, we call it independent medical exam, are the trial judges making independent appointments of doctors?
In this case, the judge made an independent appointment. He did not appoint the doctor suggested by Drackett. I really have not been back on the scene long enough to speak to the second part of your question. What I have observed occasionally is that the trial judge will simply appoint the doctor suggested by the moving party. but I really can't speak for our legal team.
I see in this potential for making the trial judge, though he doesn't want it, a partisan in the case, because inevitably the lawyer is going to argue, well, this is not our doctor, this is a doctor named by the trial judge, and therefore he is entitled to much more belief in his credibility. You got any...
any answer to that?
Any answer to that problem?
Justice Kilgarn, I really don't. We have seen that sort of thing in the record with some frequency when the trial court appoints someone. I really have no thought on how that problem can be solved, because I think we are committed to the idea that there are circumstances under which these examinations can be conducted. And if the twin requirements of incontroversy and good cause are met, then obviously they should be. Let me talk about the rule and the law that applies to it for just a moment. Rule 167A is based, as I'm sure you're aware, on Federal Rule 35. Portions of it are almost exactly the same. There are some differences. We really have no Texas state cases that speak to the mental exam issue that's before you. We do have several federal cases, and I will discuss one of those in a moment. I noticed that Drackett Products has some quibble about our designation. This is a unique question, but I think it is a unique question. When you have no state case speaking to the problem before you, then it becomes unique in my view. But whether it's unique or not, it's before this court now and must be resolved. Let me begin by taking what I'll call the constitutional overview. In State Employees Union versus Department of Mental Health, this court recognized in unanimous opinion the right of privacy in Texas, and pointed out in the opinion that sections 9 and 25 of the Texas Constitution guarantee the sanctity of the individual's home and person against unreasonable intrusion. And the court then goes on to hold that there is in Texas a right of privacy, just as there is a right of privacy recognized under the United States Constitution. I think that that right is applicable here just as it was in the State Employees Union case, because once again we are intruding into, in this instance, the mental processes of a litigant. Having recognized that, the court pointed out that the right of privacy, this court pointed out, the right of privacy should yield only when there is a compelling governmental objective that can be achieved by no less intrusive or more reasonable means. I would suggest to you that this type of thing that we're dealing with in this case fits within the ambit of that right of privacy and should be, and the rule that applies to this problem should be construed and interpreted and applied with that constitutional overview in mind. And let me reiterate, one of the things that's important under that constitutional overview is that there be no less intrusive or more reasonable means of solving the problems that happens to be before the court. Now, we're not saying, of course, that Rule 167A is unconstitutional on its face. We're saying only that it must be construed consistent with the Constitution of the State of Texas. Now, within that context, let me mention and discuss for just a moment what obviously must be the leading federal case on Rule 35. It's a United States Supreme Court case called Schlegenhoff versus Holder. It's discussed extensively in both briefs. That particular case was a bus-truck collision where a Greyhound bus rear-ended a truck. And the bus passengers sued everybody. They sued the bus company, the bus driver, the truck driver, and anyone else they could find in federal court. The truck company filed a third-party action then over against the bus driver and the bus company, and then filed a motion seeking a mental examination and a physical examination, a wide-ranging one of the bus driver. The allegation was that the bus driver was not mentally and physically fit, and there was certainly some evidence to indicate that because of some things the bus driver had said about seeing stars and some other problems. Now, the Supreme Court recognized, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized initially, as this court does in the structure of Rule 167A, that there must be a good cause and in controversy twin set of conditions met. And the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, went on to say these are not met by mere conclusory allegations of the pleadings, nor by mere relevance to the case, but require an affirmative showing by the movement that each condition as to which the examination is sought is really and genuinely in controversy, and that good cause exists for ordering each particular examination. The court then points out that what may be good cause in one kind of case may not be in another, and the ability of the movement to obtain the desired information by other means is also relevant. Then, in stating the various standards, the court concluded that in that particular case, nothing in the pleadings or affidavit would afford a basis for a belief that the bus driver was suffering from a mental or neurological illness warranting wide-ranging psychiatric or neurological examination. Now, I think it's important to note that the Supreme Court placed it on the basis of mental or neurological illness, which, and I realize that we're dealing with some very subtle and slippery terms, to me, mental or neurological illness is something substantially different than the mental anguish that you see in any personal injury case. Now, there is a troublesome part of Schlegelhoff, and let me face it head on, because it certainly is going to be discussed, I'm sure, by Drackett. And of course, I recognize that that this decision in Schlegelhoff is not binding on this court. It's simply advisory, because they're not construing U.S. constitutional principles that come down over the state. There is an indication in the opinion that the U.S. Supreme Court might consider that a mental examination is warranted, that is, that the mental state of a person has been placed in controversy and that there is good cause for the examination, if the pleader has pleaded a mental anguish or a mental damage recovery, pleaded for a mental anguish or mental damage recovery. But the court goes on later to say, and I think it's directly pertinent here, mental and physical examinations are only to be ordered upon a discriminating application by the district judge of the limitations prescribed by the rule. To hold otherwise would mean that such examinations could be ordered routinely in automobile accident cases. And I think that's the primary danger that we're looking at here, and that's why it's so important to craft some guidelines for the use of this rule that will not result in that happening. So where are we? Well, we have two factors in this case. We have allegations and we have evidence. The first thing the court will have to decide is whether allegations of mental anguish are defensive allegations of some kind of pre-existing condition because of the mental state of the plaintiff are enough to satisfy the in controversy and good cause requirements of Rule 167A. Of course, our position is that it is not and should never be because the mental anguish allegation is one that is going to be made in virtually every personal injury case, and if that's sufficient, then in virtually every personal injury case, the plaintiff is going to be subject to a wide-ranging series of mental examinations within whatever scope the trial judge sees fit. I would urge the court initially to reject the idea that the mere allegations are enough. So the question then becomes, if the mere allegations are not enough, what about the evidence? What evidence does it take to satisfy the in controversy and good cause requirements? And let me speak to that in two ways. First, the evidence in this case. About all I can do is reiterate what I've already said. There is no connection in the evidence between the pre-existing mental state of Mrs. Coates and the mental anguish that she testified will be the basis of her claim in this case. The pre-existing mental state was a depression brought on by marital problems and an illness of the son and a loss of a job. The post-injury mental anguish that she testified that she suffers and for which she seeks recovery is the embarrassment and the public knowledge that she has a scarred arm that will be seen by the public as she goes about her daily business. What's missing in this record is the connector. You see, there is no medical evidence tendered independently of the records of Mrs. Coates' pre-existing condition. We don't have an affidavit from a doctor. We don't have a doctor getting on the stand in support of the motion for mental exam. We have nothing other than the discovery information that was laid on the judge's desk. So there is no connector. There's no one saying, yes, this depression could cause her to be less attentive and therefore cause her to stray her arm. Or yes, this depression could cause her after the accident to be more embarrassed than she would be or to be more upset than she would be because of the injury. There is no connector. And there's nothing in this record to tell us that the two different mental states have any relevance to each other. So I suggest to you that on this record, the Drackett Products Company has not carried its burden. That it has the burden, has the heavy burden of proving the in-controversy and good cause requirements, and it has not met that burden. Now, on a more objective level, the question, of course, is what will carry the burden. That basically is something the court's going to have to decide, and I really don't have a great deal to suggest in that regard, except that I think it, number one, must be more than we have in this case. I think that if the party places it in controversy by an indication that he or she is going to use mental health experts than it is in controversy. I think if there is a deep-seated mental illness of some sort that's going to play a factor in the case, or that in some way could have caused the problem that led to the lawsuit, then, of course, then the controversy and good cause requirements have been met.
Suppose it's mental anguish that results in physical manifestations.
Well, I think you're getting to the point there, perhaps, where examinations are warranted. Again, we're getting into the situation where it's going to require medical testimony to prove this in almost every case. And I think the moment a party advances or makes known the intent to present medical testimony in a particular area, that alone is enough to put it in controversy and provide good cause. Here's the bottom line about what my concern is. The pre-existing condition of Mrs. Coates is so minimal that you're going to see in every case in which the opposing party decides the
other party should be subjected to mental exam, you're going to see a deposition that goes something like this. Well, now tell me, Mrs. Coates, have you ever been depressed? Well, yes. If they're honest, they're going to say, sure, I have. Have you ever been depressed within the year before this injury? Well, sure, I've been depressed. All right, do you deny that you have suicidal tendencies? Well, of course I deny. Now, that's this record. And if on these facts a mental exam is warranted, then on that kind of deposition a mental exam is warranted. And I suggest that with the constitutional overview of right of privacy and with a fair interpretation of the rule, that is too much. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you this morning.
Can we decide this case under the Texas Constitution?
Yes, sir, you can. There is no need to refer at all to the U.S. Constitution on this. And Schlegelhoff, being a U.S. Supreme Court decision, as I indicated, is only advisory to this court because it does not establish any firm U.S. constitutional principles that you've got to follow.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We will now hear argument from respondents.
At the court, Ms. Judy Norris and Mr. Frank Finn will present argument for respondents. Ms. Norris will open.
May it please the court. I think what we're here today on is a specific issue, and the issue is, did the trial court abuse his discretion when he ordered the Rule 167A examination? It must be considered by this court also that this is a discovery rule. This is not a rule of evidence concerning admissibility. This is a discovery rule, and as we all know, discovery is not a one-way street in civil litigation. The relator is correct when the relator points to two specific factors this court must look at, the good cause in controversy issue and then the good cause issue. Now, what did the trial court have when he made this ruling in ordering the Rule 167A examination? This is a personal injury action in which Mrs. Coates alleges that she had suffered physical injury and mental anguish, both past and future, as a result of using Mr. Muscle Oven Cleaner. Now, if the court, and we have cited and attached as our exhibits in our sworn exhibit volume, I think you'll find them at exhibits 14, 15, and 16, the specific evidence, deposition testimony, and admissible medical records which point to the fact that this condition, this mental examination, is necessary because her mental condition is in controversy under Rule 167A.
This seems, at least from what I saw in the briefs, turn on the definition of mental condition. What for you, how do you define mental condition as set out in the rule?
Well, Your Honor, under the case law and under the rules, the mental condition, as I see it, is any sort of condition in which the mental stability or faculties or anguish of the relator or the plaintiff are in controversy. In this case, the plaintiff has brought her mental condition into controversy by requesting damages, both past and future, as a result of what she claims is an exorbitant remorse or mental anguish that was caused by Dracut Product Company's product, the Mr. Muscle Oven Cleaner. In this case, the specific issue that Dracket Products Company has a right to present evidence to rebut is that any sort of mental anguish that she is claiming was in fact caused by other factors other than what she is now claiming. The jury is going to be asked to award money, to award damages as a result of mental anguish, and all Dracket Products Company, or part of what they are asking for, is the opportunity to present the evidence to establish that this mental anguish, this embarrassment, this depression that she is feeling is as a result of other factors other than what she is claiming as a result of the product.
So how do you relate that to the rule you take the plaintiff the way as you find him?
Well, Your Honor, you do take the plaintiff the way you find them. However, under the discovery rules, the defendant is also allowed the ability to rebut the plaintiff's allegations and also to come forward with affirmative evidence. In this case, you have the date of the accident being October 26, 1986. Now, if you look through the exhibits, the medical records, from January through October of 1986, Mrs. Coates was on antidepressants, prescribed drugs. She continuously complained of depression. These are not her own, however, complaints of depression that are in the record. You have the annotations by the doctors, independent doctors in the record, doctors that were treating her, saying that she was depressed, she had an inability to eat or sleep, her husband was an alcoholic, there were marital problems. In fact, the marital problems were such that at the time of the incident that she is suing for in this case, there was a separation from her husband for approximately 6 to 8 weeks. Now, the medical records show that on June 25, 1986, Elavil, an antidepressant, was prescribed, and that she was suffering from bruising and nervousness. Approximately 1 month later, in what appears to be a psychotherapy record, there were, on July 25, 1986, there are notations of depression, very nervous and upset, not sleeping or eating. The husband is an alcoholic. Then only 5 days, and 6 days before the incident, Your Honors, she was at the doctor's, and again she was complaining of having personal problems. She can't eat or sleep. She was taking these antidepressant drugs. And this is a point that I think that has not been brought up to, and is in the facts in this case and in this record. But approximately 5 days before the accident with the Mr. Muscle Oven Cleaner, she also suffered another burn, in which a gas flame burned the inside of her arm. Now, it's important, the same area where the Mr. Muscle Oven Cleaner is alleged to have caused damage. Now, if you tie this previous factor of the previous burn in with the fact that at the very same time as that previous burn, let's call it the first burn, she was also complaining of depression, of having personal problems. There raises the inquiry of distraction, of some sort of other condition of the plaintiff that in fact might have caused her injuries that she is today seeking to recover relief from Dracket Products Company.
Let me ask you, in terms of the rule that you advocate, is it your idea that any time that a plaintiff alleges mental anguish, that a defendant is entitled to a psychiatric exam, or would you place limits on it? And, of course, in deciding this case, we can take into consideration the facts, but we've got to draw a rule that's going to apply across the board. Would you apply that right to a mental examination across the board when mental anguish is alleged?
Your Honor, I believe that this isn't a cop-out type of response, but this is an abuse of, this is a discretionary matter for the trial judge under the discovery rule.
But don't we have to write a rule that determines when it's an abuse of discretion and when it isn't?
I believe, Your Honor, that the abuse of discretion is not a black and white answer. This is a gray area, and that is why the trial court judge sits there and, as in this case, looks at the facts, looks at the evidence, and considers the specific case. I don't believe that this court can write a rule that will cover all cases just by reading it.
Well, what?
But shouldn't the burden be on you to show, before you can get this examination, that you will be put at a disadvantage, you will have an unfair trial?
Your Honor, I believe that, in fact, this was shown in this case. I have not found that that is, in fact, the burden that is put on, for example, the federal court defendants under Rule 35 specifically.
Let me read you something then.
Out of Lowe against Philadelphia newspapers, in order to show good cause, the defendant must be able to show that he has a true need for information which would jeopardize his ability to obtain a fair trial.
Your Honor, and I'm sorry, I'm just not familiar with that specific case under that citation. Is that under Rule 35 or is that under the discovery rule?
Cite that Holder case.
Well, Your Honor, I believe what you find here is because of the specific fact situation. And that is what the court must look to. This is a discretionary matter. And because of the facts, and that's why I was going through this long list and why we've attached the evidence concerning these specific facts in this case. It's not a situation where every personal injury case, the defendant will be entitled to a mental examination. And the trial court was clear in that in his ruling and in his order. Because in this case, it showed that there was a question of not only the mental anguish that she's now seeking damages for as being proximately caused by her accident with Mr. Muscle Cleaner, perhaps there was a question as to whether it was in fact caused by other factors. And then something that we haven't gotten into.
Are you saying that when you, after the doctor examines the patient, do you think you may have some evidence developed that this was an intentional injury? That is, a cry for help or some kind of self-destructive technique? Or do you think that you may just be trying to show inadvertence or inattention, which would amount to contributory negligence?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that in the discovery, what we'd like to do is find out what the true facts were. We don't know what we will have. We believe that the facts, the record in this case, permits us and meets that burden of requiring this mental examination to allow us to get an independent examination, not rely simply upon a layperson wearing a coat for self to say what did or did not cause the problem. I think that the fact that on October 27th, there was an independent inquiry or question raised by the emergency room doctor at Trinity Medical Center as to the suicidal tendencies. It is absolutely correct, as Relator's counsel mentioned, that the notation was husband denied suicidal tendencies. That's a denial by a layperson.
People recognize that. They got a list. They go to interns or particularly that happen in a hospital. And that's a question you got to ask, you know. Does she have suicidal tendencies? No, she doesn't have suicidal tendencies, so they make a note of it.
Well, Your Honor, this was not a checklist type of question, and I don't know that that is the question that they are going to always ask. I do know that in the evidence in this case, it was an independent inquiry raised by someone, and possibly, and what we believe, because of the fact that only 5 days before, on the same day that she was seeking the medical attention for depression and personal problems, she suffered another burn.
Yeah, what have they written down there? Denied venereal disease. Are we going to presume that she's got DD or something? Well, they're put down there to deny that.
No, Your Honor, that's not what we're saying. What we are saying is that because of the plaintiff's claim for the mental anguish damages, and because we believe that we have brought forward the evidence that her own misuse of this product under the comparative negligence theory that we have claimed would establish that we are entitled to the mental examination under the rule.
Well, Justice Barrett asked you a very valid question. We have to write an opinion in this case, and we need help. We need help from both sides. Our mental examination to be allowed when there's an allegation of neurosis or psychosis. Are you going to equate mental anguish with neurosis or psychosis and say that therefore there ought to be a mental examination allowed on a mere pleading of mental anguish, or you have to be elevated to neurosis or even worse, psychosis, before you're entitled to mental examination?
Your Honor, I believe that the mere pleading in this specific case is not all that you have. I think that you do have, and the defendant has come forward with this independent extra, shall we say, evidence of a mental condition.
It would not be admissible.
Isn't
that going to be admissible at the time of the trial of the case?
Well, Your Honor, I can't say for sure whether it will be admissible at this time or not, but what we're talking about is the discovery to determine if there is admissible evidence out there.
They say they're not going to call an expert witness. They say that they're only complaining that because of the incisiveness of the burn, that she feels uncomfortable in public. That's what I understand Mr. Countess's representations to be. Now, why should you be entitled to bring in an expert witness to
they ever talk about any more than that.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that we have the right as a litigant in civil litigation to come forward with rebutting evidence that not only rebuts in a point-by-point and a reliance upon plaintiff's promise not to say something in trial and evidence about this, or a promise not to bring a witness. We have a right to rebut not only their case in chief, but also bring forward evidence of our own affirmative defenses, and those affirmative defenses include misuse. Misuse would necessarily, in this case, assume her either latent self-destructiveness or inattentiveness. There's been an allegation of failure to warn. We have a right to discover what, in fact, this woman's condition was, that whatever we might have thought, she would not have been able, she didn't even pay attention to me. I think that what we have to focus here on, however, is that under the standard of review before this court, and Equitable Johnson versus Fourth Court of Appeals opinion, that this court has to determine that the trial court's decision was so arbitrary and unreasonable and just flew in the face of the facts and evidence before him that there was but one decision that this court, trial court could have made, and that all discretion had been extinguished. Dragic's request is not without support. We have cited the cases in our brief. The Anson case I was forward to this court, which was Anson versus Pickle, was almost in the exact same factual situation as we have before it, in which the mental examination was granted. There was a pre-existing psychiatric evidence or depression in that case. The relief sought by the plaintiff was for compensation for physical injury and emotional distress. There was no allegation that the plaintiff was going to bring forward a psychiatrist at trial. However, the court recognized that the nature and the seriousness of the distress raised the mental condition into controversy, and that because this is a case-by-case analysis situation.
Counsel, I can't accept that. I'm going to have to ask you to give us a better idea of how to decide these cases other than on a case-by-case basis. We have to lay down a rule. And I asked you about it a while ago. You said, well, it's just a question of abuse of discretion. And that depends upon the facts of the case. I believe that's what you, in essence, your answer was.
And you're arguing facts to us as providing you are the entitled to a mental examination.
And I'm not disputing the validity at this point of what you're saying. I'm asking you, how can we lay down a rule as to when an injured plaintiff who has alleged mental anguish, under what circumstances is the defendant going to be entitled to subject him to a psychological or psychiatric examination?
And you tell me, if you're going to win this lawsuit, how to write a rule that would allow you to be able to do that, and one and a rule that will last farther than this case, other than abuse of discretion?
I think that, Your Honor, where you show that the seriousness of the mental condition of the plaintiff, it comes into controversy where, by pre-existing conditions, where such condition is impacts upon not only the evidence of the damages that he's seeking, but also her own, the own facts going toward the use of the product, for example, in this case. But that is where you show that you have the mental condition is in controversy by the plaintiff's own pleadings and also by the affirmative showing of a defendant, and that there is good cause, as in this case, where you have the medical records that raise the issue, and there will be no answer without this independent inquiry.
Well, counsel, everybody has a right to privacy now, at least after our recent decision in the MHMR case. Now, in order to get beyond the right of privacy of this individual, in the test that you would get an unfair trial if you're not allowed to have this person examined by a psychologist or psychiatrist.
Your Honor, I believe that is true, that we would be denied our ability to discover the facts and to present rebutting evidence and to affirmatively show that the damages sought and the accident itself were caused not by the defendant's product, but by the plaintiff's own condition. And at this point, I believe that I'd like to close and allow Mr. Finn to address the court by just saying that there has been no showing of an abuse of discretion in this case. There has been, however, specific factual evidence that has been presented to the court that the mental condition of Myrna Coates was in controversy by her own pleadings and by Drackett's affirmative showing, and that there is good cause that has been established for Drackett to need this mental examination in order to proceed at trial in a fair trial and in order to for justice to be done.
In other words, you're arguing that the court has already laid down its rule in 167A, and we just got to decide what we meant when we put that, when we promulgated, huh?
I believe so, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court. I would like to refer briefly to several of the remarks and the arguments made by Mr. Countess. I then would like to address several of the questions that have been asked by the members of the court. Let me say in the beginning that if there is a problem here, Your Honor, and the court needs a rule, from my perception, the problem has been created by the plaintiff's bar and by the plaintiffs. I am thus somewhat chagrined when I hear Mr. Countess say, they are not entitled to an expert because we have made our announcement, we don't intend to call an expert. We're going to, in this matter, rely upon lay witnesses. Well, the goose and the gander used to feed from the same trough. And if it's sauce for the goose, it should be for the gander. I'm a member of ATLA, always desirous of knowing what is coming down the pipe. Most recently, matter of fact, the last announcement of ATLA as to its annual convention. Tuesday, August the 2nd, the tort law section, contemporary techniques in proof of damages. Maximizing the award in the SCAR case, coping with chronic pain syndrome cases, proving the emotional wound, psychological injuries, use of the neuropsychologist to prove damages in the moderate closed head injury case. The plaintiffs have created a situation in which they say, we are entitled to allege and offer proof from expert witnesses as to mental anguish. Now, today we're having trouble defining mental anguish, but the plaintiffs have defined it in their brief. The mental anguish claims made by a plaintiff in this case are based solely on the emotional distress that typically accompanies a severe second-degree burn. Well, isn't it going to be helpful to the fact finder to hear from someone who addresses that very question as to this lawsuit, the emotional distress of this lady? Was it caused by
Mr.? If they're just seeking an award from the jury for typical emotional distress that one would ordinarily suffer by this kind of injury, and they don't seek to personalize it to this person's own state of mind other than just being one of 4 billion people alive, then couldn't you call some type of expert who had not made a personal examination?
I could, Your Honor, but his testimony is less effective than the expert witness who has examined the plaintiff. We've all heard the argument, the closing argument. What does this man know? He never even saw the plaintiff. Yes, I could, but I don't think the rules of civil procedure should relegate me to that post. I hear Mr. Countess say this condition, mental anguish, is not permanent. And we don't intend to say that it is. Thus, we make an announcement, no expert witness. And he says there is no connector. Well, the connector is the expert we here seek. That was appointed by the court, not my psychologist, not anybody's psychologist, an individual appointed by the court, named by the court, independent, as to whose opinion I have no way of knowing. I'm taking my chance, but I'm willing to do so. Why? Well, I'm suspicious, maybe, and I shouldn't be. When the plaintiff says, we don't intend really to seek expert guidance in this matter, we're going to entrust it to lay witnesses, I'm curious as to how legitimate, how real, and why not, if they're serious about it. And I think I'm entitled to find out. Your Honors, they open the door. Why should they be able to decide when I'm entitled to an expert? And yet, that's the argument. A question was raised, well, don't you take the plaintiff as you find him? Absolutely. But I'm entitled to find out how I found her. What was her emotional state? How much anxiety did she have? Because she was embarrassed. Her son had health problems. She was embarrassed. Her husband had drinking problems. She was embarrassed. She lost a job. I think the rule, Your Honor, is when the plaintiff in pleadings seeks recovery for mental anxiety, for mental stress, for mental pain and suffering, the defendant under the rule cited is entitled to a psychological evaluation and examination.
Stop right there, Mr. Pan. I want to make sure I understood what you said. Any time they allege mental anguish, you're saying that the defendant is entitled to an examination by a psychiatrist or a psychologist?
As appointed by the trial court.
Mr. Penn, will you stay at the rostrum so the recorder can get you? I may want to listen to this later.
Sure.
Thank you. Answer your question then, please.
Yes.
Yes. Any time the allegation of mental anguish is alleged, you're entitled to an examination.
I make my motion, and the trial judge should be authorized to order such an examination. Yes, sir. I think that's what Rule 167 is about. I think that's why it was written. And I don't think it ought to turn on whether or not the plaintiffs say they intend to utilize an expert.
What about the element of the rule about good cause shown? You will not read that in? Should we just...
Good cause...
Pretend that good cause, that the requirement's not there?
I think I've satisfied the requirement. It is there, Your Honor. The good cause is the fairness to both sides.
So the good cause ad initio, because mere pleading, if I'm saying your argument, mere pleading, mental anguish by a plaintiff, the defendant does not show good cause because everybody seeks fairness in trial, and by definition, that requirement is met.
I think so, Your Honor. Yes, to be fair with the court. I think we've reached the point in today's trial advocacy where the assertion, it is held by this court, is sufficient to send it to the jury. I think the jury is entitled to all the help they can get. I don't find an invasion of privacy any more than it invades my client's privacy to be sued. I think the fact finder is entitled to all the help the fact finder can get.
I have some concern, and if you would address this, about a plaintiff who gets injured in an automobile accident, goes into court, and as a result of their, let's say, admitted physical injuries, they claim that they have suffered mental anguish in connection therewith, and I would say laymen would generally agree with that. Are they to lay themselves bare to a psychologist who's going to examine them and testify in court about all their faults and foibles and weaknesses, and undergo perhaps and probably, if I may say, a humiliating experience in court simply to secure their damages for their physical and mental injuries? And I have some concern about that, and it's related to the question I asked the young lady about whether or not you're going to be entitled to an exam every time mental anguish is alleged. And would there be any, I can't think of an exception that she admitted to. Would you admit to any?
No, Your Honor, I hope you'll know where I'm coming from and that I'm clear. I don't see it as the terrible juggernaut that perhaps you do.
Allay my fears, please.
the psychologist that we suggested to the court that the court did not appoint, and I don't know the court-appointed psychologist, specialized in birds for years, a PhD in psychology. We picked him to help us and the jury determine how permanent, how severe, how embarrassing, other features. It's a two-hour examination, 1 hour of which is written. You take all these tests and answer all these questions. In the Delta trials, Your Honor, we found psychological testimony extremely helpful to show the trier of the fact what grief is, how it's handled, when it passes, when it diminishes, of what duration you can expect, and whether or not this individual is suffering true grief syndrome, and how it will disappear, how it can be handled, and when it ought to be gone. I think that's helpful. I think that's fair.
Let me understand you. Are you saying that you asked the court to appoint a psychologist?
In this case?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Clear reading of the rule says you're entitled to an examination by a physician. A psychologist is not a medical doctor.
He is not. But as Mr. Countess has pointed out, that distinction no longer is made by the trial judges, and I don't think it should be.
Well, whether it's made by the trial judges or not, it's clear language of the rule.
Well, then the court can appoint a psychiatrist, Your Honor. Personally, I have found more meaningful and more helpful the testimony of a psychologist. Maybe it's because I can understand.
But if you're basing your claim and entitlement under Rule 167A, then it seems that the relief has got to be in card with what 167A authorizes.
I think, Your Honor, 167A read broadly encompasses a PhD in psychology as well as a physician. The human arts are the same. They're admitted
to hospitals. If you find how to read it broadly, I invite you to file a supplemental brief. PhD psychologist, even if they're clinical psychologists, are not physicians.
Mr. Finn, on the point earlier raised about this being a discovery rule, then if your relief that you're requesting is granted, you still have the admissibility hurdle to cover. You're not, at this point, arguing admissibility.
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
You're arguing discovery at this time.
And I think our discovery ought to be as broad as the rule prescribes, whether the plaintiffs say they're going to call an expert or not.
Put your papers down 1 second. I think I heard quite a bit of distinction in what you and your co-counsel stated. Your co-counsel, in answer to Judge Spears' question, seemed to me was trying to craft a rule that would distinguish between the ordinary garden variety physical pain and mental anguish pleading and damage submission that we see so frequently that lumps those together. In a case whereas in this one, she said there was a substantial question as to whether the mental processes of the, or mental condition of the plaintiff might have contributed to the injury, either intentionally or accidentally. But I didn't hear you make any reference to this mental examination in any way possibly leading to relevance in the liability facts.
And omission.
Are you coming at us kind of Mutt and Jeff from two different sides, or is it your feeling that if we crafted a rule like that, it would just be too narrow to affect justice?
Dictated.
We crafted a rule that limited it, that recognizing the rights of privacy that a plaintiff has, that would limit that examination to where it might bear on the liability facts of the case, or where the plaintiff has put an unusual mental condition in issue by bringing their own testimony about that.
An omission dictated only by paucity of time, Your Honor. I thought co-counsel had handled that very well, and I certainly agree. There is here an additional feature to be covered by such an examination, and that is, was it, this lady took from, not the oven, from the top of her stove, a burner. She admitted in deposition that she held it cradled it in her arm and took the can of oven cleaner and sprayed it and her arm. Thoughtless, perhaps, but nonetheless deliberate, not caring, not taking into account her own safety or her own well-being. Yes. Answering your question, it is important in this case, Your Honor, for that reason. Addressing a fair question.
But you would not limit a rule to, I mean, you'd think it would be an injustice to craft a rule around the special circumstances of this case.
Well, it can be done, but addressing a member of the court, I would say if sued for mental anguish, and if it's a serious claim, and we're not spending time or money on frivolous matters, I think defendants today are in the right to do so and can't afford to do so. But I think we're entitled under those circumstances. Everyone seems to assume that which isn't at all true, that this report or this opinion will be helpful to the defendant. It may not. It may be helpful to the plaintiff. We don't know.
Mr. Finn.
But I think we're entitled to find out.
Is it your contention that a psychologist is a health care provider?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're going to get us a supplemental brief?
Be glad to.
All right, sir.
Because they're admitted to hospitals.
Is a health care provider, all right, sir.
And we'll address that.
All right, sir. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both.
Thank you. I'm sorry I ran out of time and ran over.
All right, sir.
I appreciate it.
You did not run over on your own. We asked you four questions.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, about the first day I was in the Army, I learned that the correct answer when some superior officer was pointing out that you had erred was to simply say, no excuse, sir. And Justice Kilgarland, my response to, I think, the last question you asked is, no excuse, sir. We have not argued and presented the idea that the examining person must be a physician. That's clearly what the rule says. Let me say this. While, of course, as an advocate, we are always willing to take a victory any way we can get it, I would hope that this court will still use this case, regardless of its view of the physician requirement, will still use this case to craft the guidelines that we've been discussing. And let me respond quickly to two areas. I want to go back once again for just a moment to the evidence in this case, because I think in all action that's taken in this case, that first must be kept in mind. And I want to stress once again what I said several times, that there is no connection in the record in this case between the pre-existing condition and the mental anguish that's sought. Now, counsel for Drackett spoke in terms of all of the things that they hope to be able to prove after this examination, and yet there is not a word in this record that indicates that any kind of examination could lead to any kind of admissible evidence or could lead to any kind of information that would assist the Drackett Company in determining whether or not this mental anguish really exists. There is not a word in this record, not a word, that would indicate that any kind of mental examination can tell the Drackett Company whether or not the pre-existing condition caused inattentiveness or suicidal tendencies or anything else that caused Mrs. Coates to spray her arm either carelessly or on purpose.
You're saying, I think, that the general standard of discovery, that is, may tend to lead to the discovery of relevant evidence, is not applicable in this rule because we have the good cause standard superimposed on it that trumps it, as it were. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, I think that certainly is correct.
In other words, we can't think of this in the way we think of the ordinary discovery case,
yes,
where
yes,
the
yes.
burden is really, I think, on the, I think we've made clear on the person opposing discovery,
yes, sir,
to show how this cannot lead to anything helpful. But you're saying this one rule is different.
Yes, sir, I think it is. And I think by its very language of imposing the incontroversy and good cause requirements, it demonstrates that it is. And that recognition is present in the opinion in Slagenhoff. As you work through the Slagenhoff, you'll see that the court talks of it being something more than the relevancy standard of ordinary discovery matters.
Let me ask you what I asked the other side, and that is, should the test be that the privacy of your client, in order to be invaded, would have to be the possible result of an unfair trial unless they got to your client's mental thinking?
Yes, Mr. Justice Ray, I think that is ultimately the test you're going to come down to. Because you are in an area of privacy, one of the inquiries, and there are a number, but one of them is there any other way to develop this information? But of course, preceding that must be some showing that there is information to be developed. There is something that can be found by doing these things that somebody wants done that will affect the trial in any way, that will produce admissible evidence or whatever.
Well, should that go back, though, to the discretion of the trial judge? He would have to pass upon that issue when the motion by the examiner is made.
Yes, I think that is correct. It is within the trial judge's discretion, but of course that discretion will be abused if he doesn't meet the standards imposed under the rule. And our argument is that in this instance, the standards imposed by the rule were not met, so that there is an abuse of discretion by Judge Whittington in this particular case.
Do you really see this rising to constitutional dimensions?
Well, I think that the interpretation of the rule, yes, sir, to answer your question, I do, because the interpretation of the rule must be consistent, among other things, with the right of privacy that this court recognizes.
Well, we just went through the Lunsford case, about a defendant's obligation, or any person who's been sued for exemplary damages, obligation to produce sometimes sensitive information about net worth, and nobody mentioned or thought about constitutional dimensions to that. We look at it in terms of what's the fairest trial, and how do we balance people's rights and sensibilities in getting to a fair result.
Well,
is this different because it's a moral question, or is there something else that makes it?
My view
would, the constitutional dimension.
My view would be that it is somewhat different. I can perceive, and I'm not really prepared to speak to this in depth, unfortunately, but I can perceive a difference between the production of business records or the production of material things that are used in some activity and an invasion of the mind or the body of an individual litigant. Because I think certainly in that latter area, you're getting into these zones of privacy. The right simply not to have people poking and pulling and making you take tests and do all the things that go with this kind of thing. So it seems to me there is some difference there. Now, let me go where angels fear to tread and speak to the question that was asked a number of times about what kind of rule this court should write. Our position, number one, is that allegations of mental anguish are not enough. Because if they are, then, as this court recognizes, I think, from its questioning, or at least I hope that it does, and certainly as we believe, in every case you face this. In every case, the plaintiff, if you will, or the defendant, if the allegations are there, would face the prospect of facing a physician, let me rephrase that, a physician, and that would indicate a psychiatrist, with all that goes with that. I think then that we would come to this. I think that an allegation of some type of mental situation supported by evidence, one, that the party has their own expert in that same field, and therefore the other side is entitled to counter that with experts, would provide the incontroversy good cause required to do it. I think absent that, if the person has, and let me try to group all this together, if the person has either a history of some kind of mental derangement, the person is seeking more than mere mental anguish, as we understand that term as it's defined in Moore and some of your other cases, or is seeking a mental anguish of a definable, specified nature. There was some mention a few moments ago of the grief syndrome. I've not worked on the Delta cases, but it may be that that is an identifiable mental state. If you're into that area and at the motion hearing for the mental exam, there is evidence that a psychiatrist or whoever the person may be that's going to conduct the exam can examine those areas and can determine within reasonable expert beliefs whether or not these events occurred, whether or not the mental state exists, what it is, what its duration is, where it's going, what it may do. In other words, can look at the person and by examination and testing determine the validity of the situation in a way that it's admissible into court. Then I think perhaps the good cause in controversy requirements have been met. But to simply throw on the bench of the judge some pre-existing depression because of marital problems, a denial of suicidal tendencies, and say, okay, that's enough, let's subject this person to mental exam, I think that's not enough.
I think that answers Mr. Finn. That response is that he brought up on the test he would have us make. But what about the things Ms. Norris suggested? That is the possibility, not proved, not even, I think, on this day of the record would be raised at trial, but the possibility that this examination might show for this particular claim either possibly an intentional injury because of grief or such total disregard for one's safety due to some particular mental problems. In other words, doesn't go to the damage issue at all, but goes to the liability issue. I mean, surely the trial judge has to have the discretion to craft that out as a fourth part of the test, and then the question is there any evidence here? I mean, you would not say that could never be raised as a defense.
No, I would not, and I'm not taking that position, or I don't mean to. I think, again, to some extent, in fact, to a large extent, it gets back to what, at the motion hearing, the trial judge has shown can be determined or developed if this particular test is run. That would be my response to that.
So in this case, if that were valid, and if this were part of, if this is a physician, if it's valid to look to mental condition for liability facts only, and if that were presented to Judge Whittington in the record below, and I'm not sure it is, if that was even part of the argument, but if it were, then we would have to find an abuse of discretion on the part of Judge Whittington under these facts in order this exam, order for you to prevail. Isn't that correct?
Yes, sir. I think that's correct.
And you think we have that on this record?
Yes, I do.
I assume that both sides are probably going to file some sort of post-submission briefs. I think it'd be helpful to the court if you would each outline what you think the rule ought to be in your own language.
Yes, sir.
Ordinarily, we give you about as much time as you want, but since we're nearing the end of the term here,
when would you like to have it? We'll have it whenever you.
Well, I think because of the changes in the court personnel, we'd like to have an opportunity at least with this case with judges who heard the argument. So we probably need a week. I mean, I know that's tight.
I'll have it.
Ordinarily, we give more, but
it'll be in the clerk's office a week from today or earlier.
Any other questions?
Well, Mr. Countess, is it your position that this is a court-ordered examination by the examiner of the court's choice? And if it were performed from your client, and the results were that normal, average, healthy, wholesome response is what your client has made to this injury, that it's totally favorable, that she just is anxious because of the stigma and depressed over it. Would that not be something that you would want to use during the trial? Wouldn't it work both ways and be evidence that would be helpful to your case?
Yes, I think that certainly the possibility always is present that the evidence can go either way. Depending on which way it goes, that's going to be the determining factor on which party wants to use it. The problem that I face, though, with the scenario that you describe is that we don't know from this record or really from any kind of common knowledge that there's any kind of test a psychologist or psychiatrist can run that will really tell us that. Now, it well may be that that can be done, or that an expert can do certain things and cause the formation of an opinion in that area, but we don't know that from this record.
He might also address for us that, who should pick the doctor.
All right.
We'll be happy to do so, Your Honor.
I think I know which one you're going to recommend.
Well, I think Judge Kilgarlin raises a valid point. The trial judge under the rule has discretion to do that, but it might lead to the difficulty I have. Most trial judges defer to the party requested.
Well,
and then you, if that gives the other party the option of criticizing the credibility of that doctor. When the trial judge does it, I suppose the trial judge just has to handle that by orders of. I mean, there are remedies the trial judge can craft to keep anybody from using that to unfair advantage.
And is there some independent agency that might recommend certain doctors to the judge?
Well, you know, I have seen in records. I'm sorry.
As opposed to the lawyer.
Yes. I have seen in records, as I'm sure all of you have, the court's expert being called with words something like this, Your Honor, we want to call the court's expert now, and then turning to the jury and saying, this is the court's expert, and certainly this testimony is going to be objective and fair, and you can believe it. That completes my rebuttal, unless the court has other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will now take a brief recess.